Oyez, oyez, et oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three clauses on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Robert Bob Tilton doing business as Robert Tilton Ministries, Word of Faith Church Outreach Center, Church Incorporated and Word of Faith World Outreach Center Church and others, versus the Honorable Eric B. Moyer, an original mandamus proceeding. City of Dallas versus Sandra Harris Mitchell and others from Dallas County, and the State Bar of Texas and others versus Maria Gomez and others from Travis County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 30 minutes for petitioners or relators to present oral, 20 minutes, excuse me, for petitioners or relators to present oral argument. A portion of this time may be reserved for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. The court has allotted respondents 20 minutes for oral argument. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will complete the oral submission docket before the noon break. Two of our justices, Justices Gonzalez and Gamage, are absent today. They are both at funerals. This is the first time during this term that any member of our court has not sat on an oral argument for any reasons other than recusal or disqualification. They will not be here for any of these cases today. They will participate in the deliberations and decisions of these cases based on tapes and transcripts of the oral argument. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The argument in Tilton versus Moyer is also being videotaped. Court is now ready to hear argument from relators in Tilton versus Moyer.
May it please the court, Ms. Rhonda Bird will be presenting argument for the relators. She is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Rhonda Johnson Bird. I'm with the law firm of Thompson Co. Cousins and Irons, and I'm here today representing the relators, Reverend Robert Tilton and Word of Faith World Outreach Center Church. My co-counsel is my partner, Bob Wellenberger. Only two issues remain before the court at this time in our petition for writ of mandamus. That is, whether the trial court's order requiring production of documents responsive to request numbers 4 and 12D should stand.
Counsel, might I interrupt you before you go through your issues and ask you to first address the motion to dismiss?
Yes, Your Honor. I received yesterday the motion to dismiss, and as I understand it, the basis for that is no statement of fact has been filed in this court, and that is accurate. Relying on the case of Barnes versus Whittington decided by this court in 1988, this court has never required the parties to present a statement of facts that contains only the oration of counsel. In this particular case, there were two hearings held with regard to the motion to compel, one on March 26th and one on June 2nd, before two separate judges. There was no evidentiary hearing at either of those. Therefore, there is no statement of facts to present. There are transcripts available with regard to what transpired, but it was simply the oration of counsel.
Thank you.
And with regard to these two requests, numbers 4 and 12D, I believe there are four factors which are of paramount importance. First, the extremely overbroad nature of request number 4 on its face. Secondly, the fact that the trial court refused to conduct any in-camera inspection of documents responsive to either request, although repeatedly asked to do so. This is in the record at Exhibit H, paragraph 5, page 20, and at Exhibit K, paragraph 8, page 11. The third factor is that request number 4 is violative of precious, fundamental, and constitutional privileges, in that it seeks not only the identity by name, address, and telephone number of church followers who claim to have been healed by faith, but also this patently overbroad and intrusive request seeks all records pertaining to these individuals. Fourthly, request 12D seeks a document we contend is protected by the attorney-client privilege, which again was never reviewed in camera. Addressing request number 4 first, because it will really be the longer part of my argument, We believe the trial court ignored longstanding legal precedent by compelling production of these documents. The critical inquiry here is, why should these documents not be disclosed based on a claim of privilege, and where is it reflected in the record before this court? First of all, Word of Faith World Outreach Center Church is a church. It's a Christian church that's not disputed, that is established in the record through the affidavit of Robert Tilton, which is Exhibit D in paragraph 2. Of great religious importance to my clients is their belief in the power of prayer, their belief that God answers prayers of the faithful, and their belief in the divine healing of physical ailments through faith. This is in the record, Exhibit D, paragraph 5, and Exhibit 1 to Exhibit D, paragraph 11. Also, many church followers provide Christian testimonies of their reported healing miracles, which is the precise subject or inquiry of request number 4. This is in the record in plaintiff's original petition through a judicial admission, page 3, paragraph D. Also, attachments to Exhibit A, which were filed by opposing counsel, contain examples of these healing miracles claimed by the followers of the church. It's a fact that request number 4 is extremely overbroad, and that it seeks every record, all records of all persons who claim healing, not in any type of redacted form, not limited just to the medical records, not limited just to the healings, but all records.
Would they be entitled to that?
Excuse me?
If it were so narrowed, would they be entitled to get that?
It is possible they would be entitled to get certain records provided they were redacted. It's our position they would never be entitled to get the identities of these individuals.
If there had been some mishap at the church, perhaps a premises defect, and there had been an injury to a member of the church, in a case like that, would someone be entitled to get discovery of members of the church who had had a mishap or had been in the area of the alleged premises defect on earlier occasions?
The identities of church members, insofar as they relate to their religious practices and beliefs, we believe is simply not discoverable. If there were some other situation, which I think it would be a fact-intensive inquiry, I can envision there might be some form of situation where they could get limited records. But request number 4 would include their salvation records, their baptism records, their confessions of sin, records of their church tithings, donations, and contributions, all of which this church maintains in the form of what is called partner records.
All right, so if someone had a fall at the church, you would not think there would be any objection to determining whether any other member of the church had had a fall at the same location?
I think that there would be an objection to that. My answer is, without knowing more in that type of hypothetical to determine what would be involved,
be?
I can't answer that.
That it would be an infringement on religious freedom to identify other people who had been at church and had had falls in the same spot?
The problem I have with such a general hypothetical would be if a request was made for the church membership list, which is basically a partial membership list as sought in this case.
No, my query is just, can you determine whether any other member of the church has fallen or had a mishap at the same location?
I cannot respond to that.
Do you think that would pose a religious problem?
I would have to research that, but it very likely could.
All right. If these were limited to not including any of the records that you just described, but simply the identity of persons who said they had been healed of medical illnesses, what religious problem does that pose?
The religious problem I have here is really twofold. One is the free exercise of religious rights are being impinged upon, as well as the freedom of association. There's a very long line of cases which hold that a person has a right to join not necessarily religious organizations, but any type of even secular organization. For example, NAACP versus Alabama, Brown versus Socialist Workers Association. Those cases indicate that you have a right to join an organization and not have your membership disclosed, particularly in matters not involving religion, such as your contributions.
If two members of the NAACP had a dispute, either a physical dispute or an argument over something that became involved in the course of litigation, would we be entitled to discover the names of the persons who were present who observed this at the NAACP meeting?
I think eventually you would have to conduct a balancing test and weigh whatever the relevant privileges were in that situation, such as the right to privacy or freedom of association with the right to discovery. And there would need to be a balancing test. In this case, the court clearly conducted no balancing test because it received no evidence. Record is replete based on the fact that this court granted partial summary judgment and dismissed a fraud claim that they recognized the religious nature and the religious privileges and did not want to put this church and its pastor to proof or disproof of their religious beliefs.
So if there had been a proper evidentiary showing, you might be able to get the information.
Are you asking if plaintiff's counsel at the trial level had properly put on evidence that he might be able to gain it? I don't think so in this situation.
You're suggesting that in my NAACP example, that if there had been a proper evidentiary showing, the court could engage in balancing.
That's correct. But there would be different rights in an NAACP situation. The constitutional privileges would be presumably a freedom of association, right to privacy. This case has those elements, but additionally has the free exercise and the freedom of religion aspects. And what was requested in item number 4 is so global and so overbroad that basically it is just seeking church records. It is specifically targeted toward not only the identities, but all records that would ever purport to contain the identities of these individuals. If there was ever a purpose to the constitutional protections afforded by the First Amendment, as to free exercise of religious beliefs and freedom of association, that purpose should be demonstrated by protection of these records.
Did you have a motion for protective order with reference to request number 4?
Yes, we did.
Wasn't it your burden to put on evidence then to help the court in its balancing process?
The motion for protective order, and I'll have to go back and look at my notes to be absolutely certain of this, but as I stand here now, my belief is the court never directly addressed the motion for protective order, never gave us a court setting on that. And when we were before the court on March 26 and June 2, it was with regard to plaintiff's motion to compel. There's absolutely no legitimate reason that the church should turn over all records of any church followers in this case.
Counsel, what are the remaining tort claims made?
There's only one, for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
So this discovery request would have to relate in some way to a claim of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
We don't believe that it does. There's been no showing of that.
What is your understanding of the purpose of the request for the membership list, or that you say is comprehended by request number 4?
My understanding is based upon statements made by counsel, which is not in the record, but if I may address the court.
I think you can tell us your understanding
okay.
of what they're
My understanding is plaintiff's counsel intended to contact these church followers to determine if they had any problems. And I believe that in the reply to the petition,
if they had similar claims against your client?
Presumably, and additionally in his reply in this court, indicated they might be potential parties. And I have absolutely no idea how they could become potential parties simply because they held a religious belief that power of prayer cures illness.
It's not every day we have oral arguments televised in this court. I take it this matter has gotten a lot of publicity in the Dallas area.
An enormous amount.
And it seems likely that members of the church are likely aware of this lawsuit. Would that be a fair characterization?
Absolutely. There have been hearings where church members were called to testify, and they refused to give their last names and were even referred to such names as Eva Church Member. And contained in Exhibit T, which is the affidavit of Marty Tilton, we have presented evidence to this court that the church membership has fallen approximately 25% since 1991, which was the time of the airing by ABC of Primetime Live. There has been quite a bit of harassment and ridicule and even death threats involving certain members of the church. All is contained in the audio tapes and videotapes, which are on file with this court.
Should you be required to identify church members of whom you are aware who are in similar circumstances with the plaintiffs in this case? In other words, who have told you that they had a similar experience to the plaintiffs in this case?
That has never been requested in this case.
That would be a much narrower request.
It would be much narrower. My primary complaint about request number four is it is so incredibly overbroad, and as well as the constitutional privileges that attach, as well as the fact that no in-camera inspection was done of those records, which on their face would have shown the religious privileges which attached.
Did you tender records for in-camera inspection?
We did. We did orally in court, as well as on two occasions, which are before this court.
Can you describe the volume of that tender?
We did not physically bring the documents with us. I understand it's a very, very large number. For example, there are, or at the time this was going, there were approximately 880,000 church partners. And church partners are those people who are actual members of the church, and those individuals who have contacted the church via their prayer line and have been placed on a mailing list. Those 880,000 people each have computerized partner records which show each and every time they contacted the church for prayer, each and every time they sent some type of contribution in, the amount of each of their contributions, tithes, donations, and each of their vows to the church.
And so you told the trial court you could tender for his in-camera inspection the records on these 880,000 people, and that's what you thought request number four required?
What we offered to the court, we had a live witness in the courtroom, and we offered to put on evidence, and the court declined to hear any evidence about that.
What, specifically with reference to the tender of records in camera, which you indicated you provided, can you describe that, the nature of that tender?
The nature of the tender is as set out in the records, requesting that the court perform an in-camera inspection, and just by verbal tender.
Of what, though, is what I'm trying to get an idea of, the extent of the in-camera inspection you're seeking?
The extent at that time is much different than the scope of this case now. We have now produced over 5.5 million documents to plaintiff's counsel, and we're now down to only two categories, 4 and 12D. 12D is a one-page document with attachments. The attachments have already been produced. We simply claim attorney-client privilege on the front sheet. So that's a one-page document. With regard to the documents which comprise, which would be responsive to request four, they would have to come off the computer. And there are 880, and I don't want to mislead the court, there are 880,000 church members. All of them will not have claimed healing miracles, only some portion of those, and I don't know the percentage. But those would come off a computer. Additionally, there would be hard copy files of individuals. There would be letters that they had sent in, their confessionals, their statements regarding the healing miracles.
Ms. Bird, let me ask you, to narrow Justice Doggett's question originally about premises defect, and also following up on Justice Heck's question about members who had made complaints, would your position be different if the inquiry did not begin with the instruction that these be members of the church? Would your answer be different to Justice Doggett if you were asked to identify any witnesses to the fact of the injury, or anyone who has previously complained to the church about a premises defect, as opposed to asking, tell me your members who made the complaint? Would your answer be different?
My answer would be different in that situation. I think that information would be discoverable. And you know, the problem with this is you have some very precious constitutional privileges. And if the request is for church members' identities, then I would have a very big problem with that.
So in answer to Justice Heck's question about members who had had similar complaints to the church, would your answer to Justice Heck be different if the question was, has the church received previous complaints similar to the complaints by the plaintiffs in this case, being predicated upon them being members of the church?
If there were previous complaints, then I would assume that those individuals, first of all, there may be some type of, this is a fact-intensive situation, but depending on the situation, those members might have gone ahead and waived certain privileges, and there would not be a problem with production of those names. It would just depend on the circumstances.
Okay, thank you.
One of the principles upon which you rely has been invoked by such various groups as the NAACP, and we have currently pending before the court a similar claim by a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Can you tell me, hypothetically, are there any circumstances under which the church's membership list might be discovered? Or do you claim that the privilege is absolute?
There might be some situation, but I've not encountered it because it doesn't exist factually in this case.
And you can't think of any?
I cannot think of any. I'm not familiar with your Ku Klux Klan case, so.
Counsel, I know your time has expired, but could you very briefly explain to the court why a document that has been thrown away should still be entitled to the attorney-client privilege?
Well, first of all, the document which was thrown away is not the document they seek. 12D specifically requests Martha Tilton's copy of the memo. The document which was thrown away, which plaintiff's counsel has, obviously, is a draft. It's a typewritten document, has many mistakes on it, and it is a draft. It there was absolutely no voluntary disclosure of that.
Let me amend my question. Information contained in a communication in writing that's been thrown away, why is that still entitled to privilege?
The attorney-client privilege, I believe, still attaches unless there was some type of involuntary disclosure. And by placing, when an attorney places something in his trash receptacle, I think he has an expectation that it's not going to be gone through. Otherwise, every lawyer would shred every document that they ever worked on, every draft that they ever worked on for a client. There was simply, additionally, the attorney has no right to waive the attorney-client privilege. That privilege belongs to the client in this situation, Martha Tilton. She has certainly not waived that privilege.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. C. Tony Wright will be presenting argument for the real part of the network.
May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen. We think initially that the relator has misinformed the court about evidentiary hearings in regard to a balancing test by the court. First, Judge Morris, in October or November of 1992, stayed the matter for several months and put the burden upon the plaintiff to produce evidence or documents and a brief to the court to show extensively why the 41 documents were discoverable, needed, would show, and what we expected to get out of them total. We replied and they replied. However, they didn't bring that here before you. Additionally, after the two hearings, one by Judge Moyet and one by Judge Moss, when this writ was filed for, there was applications by the relator for rehearings on a couple of occasions, and Judge Moyet held a hearing in which there was at least, I'm not sure it's called evidence, there was testimony taken or statements by attorneys, and the court
well,
found...
Well, let me interrupt you right there. Yes. Was it statements by attorneys or was it evidence?
Well, there was documents presented.
Well,
and to be honest with you, sir, I cannot remember at this time because there was about 20 hearings in about 2 months.
And were these earlier hearings, there were some earlier hearings where there was live testimony?
There were documents presented, but the court determined they did not want to have any testimony taken.
So what good would any of that record do us on this mandamus?
Well, the court made the finding in regard that they were satisfied that the documents were discoverable. Excuse me for presuming, but I did so, that the court had conducted a follow-up balancing test because that was mentioned in their motion for rehearing and in our previous reply. And I think the Silkwood case and the Reinhart case and the Hughes case out of Fort Worth all mentioned those and were set out. And those are the type of questions that the court was asking us, those very questions, several times.
with regard to these particular categories of
documents?
Can you tell us how the membership lists, which council says would be included within your request, would relate in any way to your remaining tort claim of intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Yes, they take the offensive use of membership, what I say, propaganda, methodology, mail out, which Bob Hilton has said, I had it before Publishers Clearinghouse did, and use it, and he makes millions of dollars off of it. We contend that several, if not all, of these supporting statements therein by members and other people that they use are incorrect. And Mr. Tilton has stated in deposition that he has no medical proof of any healing except possibly one, as the gentleman supposedly cured of AIDS. They use these just like Publishers Clearinghouse. Some of those are attached to the original petition, and we believe strongly that if we can get to this information, the rest of it, besides that that was just broadcast, such as mailed out or they have, we can clearly show that they have misused what the people have said. They have misused somewhat the stuff on the
these
broadcast.
Testimonials or that's whatever.
Testimonials
that say
is a good way to put it.
Yeah,
I got healed, I got $1 million type thing. And we want to contact those people.
Have you already received documents that show people who have left the church?
That people who have what?
Left the church.
There are some documents that have been produced of people who have left the church, not totally though. Mainly the ones that have written in that they happen to keep, and it's called a status 91 or a couple other status codes, and written and complained.
So those are already in your possession?
The ones that were not destroyed, they say they have produced, and we have gone through numerous of the millions produced.
Opposing counsel suggests that your discovery request is so broad it would even include someone's baptismal records. What conceivable right to discovery would you have with reference to that?
None.
Are you seeking that?
No. What we want is the people that have claimed to be healed, the records that they have in regard to the complaints, the healing, the medical records, those type of things. We'd be glad for that to be more limited. I think, in a way, this was drawn up right after the case was filed in July of 92 when the subpoena duplicatum was issued, and of course we knew they were blocking a lot of discovery, and it's taken a lot of people, and I guess, to get where we are today. We've learned incredible amounts about the defendant since then.
Are you seeking a membership list of the defendant?
I don't read it to say membership list. It says the people that have been, they claim members that have been healed. That's a lot different from the total membership list. However, the membership list, I think we're entitled to, because we have right to contact people who are potential witnesses to see if they have similar claims or any other, know of people that have been damaged or know any of the relevant facts of this case.
So in part, you want to be able to present to the jury in this case, you want to contest the validity of the beliefs of some church members that they have in fact been healed?
It's not just the beliefs that we want to attack. We want to attack the actual fact that they have no documentation. They set up a procedure from some unlicensed doctor from the Philippines to allegedly check these, and they were not checked from the ones that had been produced. We know that.
So you are intent to present evidence that the diagnosis, I guess, of this doctor, that they have in fact been healed, and where the church member says they have been healed, you want to contest that and show that they have not been.
We have been told there are no medical diagnoses of any healing, but we do want the rest, yes.
Counsel, do you concede that the records you want, even under a more narrowly drawn statement, do implicate constitutional associational rights, and that a balance has to be undertaken by the trial court and in review by this court?
Except for the fact we think they've waived that by the offensive use of it totally. They get to go out and say people's first and last names, which they have done and do on these testimonial type stuff when they want to, and then when called upon to produce it, they want to run and hide behind a shield saying it's privileged.
How is that offensive? You, they've not used it in the courtroom.
Well, they're using it to further their money-making, which they say affidavitably that that's what the church is about giving money to Mr. Tilton.
Well, that's we're not what Mr. Tilton's done, but this constitutional right belongs to the individuals who associate it. It would have to be their waiver.
Well, I think that's already been undertaken by the U.S. Supreme Court and by the Texas court somewhat, in that once they file for their members, I don't think you could really have each member coming in here and making that argument. And I guess Ms. Tilton represents them generally. But I think there is a problem about that. Whose right really is it? It's never been addressed.
Mr. Wright, some churches have the practice at the end of the service that people come forward and give their testimonials. And you have Mr. Tilton, who apparently does this on TV.
Yes, sir.
If a member of the church comes forward and gives the testimonials on TV and therefore published and broadcast, does that member lose any constitutional interest in his association with the church or his religious belief? Is he subject to anyone who comes along and subsequently claims, well, I thought I'd be healed, but I wasn't healed. Now I want to go depose the individual who came before his church and announced that he was healed to question him about whether, in fact, he was. Is that not what's happening in this case?
Somewhat, yes, to be very straightforward. However, those documents have already been produced.
So if you get this list, you're going to call up the name on the list and say, were you really healed? Or what are you going to ask them?
We would intend to go through some of the documents and try to make some type of contact with some of them. I'm not saying we'll go all of them. I don't know how big the bread box is.
But if you get a name, you're going to call them up and say, did you go to that church? Were you really healed? Are you sure? How do you know? Or what are you going
to... What I would like to be able to do is possibly send out a questionnaire to them to see if they want to talk to us first. And if so, then we'd be glad to do a follow-up. Obviously, if there's as many as they say, which I don't believe is correct, I think this is a lot narrower than what they've tried to present to the court, then we will try to contact some of them. But if we have the records to go through first, as we have on the ones that are broadcast, then we have narrowed that down to under 100. So we're not talking about contacting everybody. I think we have the right to look at the records and decide if it further discovery is called for.
Have you been contacted by former members who are disappointed in the church or
Mr. Tilton? Yes.
And that's because of widespread publicity associated with the case?
Problem. But well,
why didn't that give you all the information that you could possibly want? The people who want to talk to you are calling you. The people who don't want to talk to you, I presume, aren't.
Well,
why doesn't that satisfy what you
I don't think the media reaches everybody quite in that context, and the media has the right to present it their way, and I don't control them whatsoever, nor do I call some of Mr. Tilton's media situations that present things in his life. Some of the people are scared, some people don't really want to get involved, but if we had the records and there was something similar or something admissible to show similar type complaints, similar type damages, then I think we ought to be able to follow up with them. Of course, a lot of times you have witnesses that are adverse also.
You suggested that you've narrowed this group to less than 100 people?
No. From the group of the ones that were broadcast on TV and going through the medical records that were produced on them, we have narrowed that down. And maybe 200, but it's no longer in the hundreds of thousands or 10,000 or anything like that.
Do you have the standard interrogatory out concerning the identity of persons with knowledge of relevant facts?
We do not. And that needs to be done, I agree.
Sorry, Mr. Wright, why isn't the decision in the Fifth Circuit on Word of Faith for Dan Morales not controlling on the issue of discovery of the members of this church?
Well, first, I think that was reversed and sent back because it's not a federal claim, and it was sent back to the court to be reevaluated to the state court. I wasn't there and didn't argue that and don't know what the Attorney General was doing and this wasn't involved. I understand the claims there are somewhat different. They were going under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and the incorporation. They went back to there, at which time Mr. Tilton became an unincorporated something or another. Who knows what he really is at this time.
and so I don't think that really applies.
It is conceivable, is it not, that church members might be at least uncomfortable and maybe object strenuously to a church handing out records of what their beliefs were, feelings were, prayer requests.
There's a very restrictive confidentiality order that goes way beyond the Reinhardt case that was drafted, reviewed, and I don't think the defendants even, they now want it changed, but at the time they thought it was pretty restrictive, and we have lived by that very much so.
You still might call these people adverse witnesses.
Well, calling the people that have maybe are alive or not alive, tracking them down is a very difficult, onerous task. Being able to write a letter to the address with a questionnaire of what we would like to talk to you or something like that on certain ones that have more relevance than others. We're not just out there calling and trying to harass anybody. And I don't think there's been any claims that we've called or harassed anybody from the...
But you did say a moment ago, in response to Justice Cornyn, that the reason that you were voluntary contacts are not sufficient. Some people may be scared and others may be hostile and adverse.
That is true. And they may not like it. But nobody made them get into the testimonial part of, oh yeah, I'm going to come down here and say this or that or the other, and I know I'm going to be likely to be used for Mr. Tilton to try to gather more money.
So you only have an associational right as long as you're quiet. That
no,
seem to be
no,
what the Supreme
not
Court
true.
Has been no. saying in socialist
and there, that does need to be balanced, I agree. Whether our need, what type of information saw, the use of it, right out of the Silkwood case and more.
You concede that whatever membership list or documents that might be produced under a confidentiality order could be challenged by the media under Rule 76A. They could intervene and contest the court's sealing or maintaining the confidentiality of that information.
I think that is a likely problem that could raise its head, yes.
And so the confidentiality order doesn't
it can't.
Give.
I don't think it can preclude the press from coming in later and trying to get into that.
So
that
there's no real assurance that that membership list will remain confidential?
Only from me it will remain confidential.
You won't give it to them?
I will not give them anything unless the court tells me to.
And in terms of the degree of intrusiveness with reference to any of these people that you learn the identities of, your plan is to send out a questionnaire.
That is correct.
And you wouldn't object to the court limiting you to doing that kind of contact initially?
Well, I think that could be initial limitation, but I think if I have the records and there's a red herring in there, I think I'll be able to follow up on it, but that could be taken care of, I guess, by further application to the court.
Counsel, if you have...
If you sent out a questionnaire and someone chose not to respond to it, what's to keep you from subpoenaing?
Well, I think the limitation of the distance involved, because these people are spread out all over the United States,
you could choose someone that lived across town in Dallas and subpoena them and ask them to come because they didn't answer your questionnaire.
We could also...
And didn't you say, though, that once they appeared one of the Tilton shows,
yes,
that they had waived some kind of right and that they ought to be able to have to respond to your questions?
I think in regard to the healing and the medical documentation or evidence thereof, I think they've waived it. And I think we're entitled to go into that, at least on a limited basis, to find out if it's a similar type complaint or we want to call them as a witness in that regard. I believe there's kind of a two-part question that you asked there, and I'm not sure exactly if that totally responds.
Well, my question is that if you send out a questionnaire and someone chooses not to respond, even though they may have appeared 10 times on television, for Tilton, if they choose now not to have anything to do with it, shouldn't they have the right to remain silent?
Well, depends on what the record would indicate. If there's further indication that they might be a potential witness or somebody that could testify to damages, kind of a other similar plaintiff situation. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Any further questions?
No, excuse me.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, do you concede that any church member who wants a copy of the records that you keep on computer and in a hard file has the right to that information?
If a church member desired their own personal records, they would certainly have a right to those records.
Does your client honor such requests?
Yes.
So that anyone who contacted the plaintiffs in the underlying case with a similar story or with a complaint would have the right to get whatever records you have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Clear abuse of discretion by the trial court, I think, has been proved by the record and further demonstrated by opposing counsel's own statements here in this court. He confesses over breath with regard to the baptism documents. He confesses he wishes to contest these people's religious beliefs. He basically wishes to engage in religious persecution.
If he made a narrow request to your client that asked about the people who had made complaints that you are aware of, similar to those that he is making in this case, do you contest his right to that information?
Absolutely. I contest his right to obtain the identities of these individuals. These individuals have a right to practice their religious beliefs and to be let alone. If he were to contact them...
So there is no balancing that takes place under your theory as long as it requests a membership list or requests identity of any church member. It's absolute.
I think that a balancing test needs to be done anytime you have competing issues.
There are no competing issues in your...
In this situation, we've not seen what the competing issue is. We've heard argument about a right to discovery, but we have seen no legitimate interest in obtaining those records to support that right of discovery.
And why wouldn't the identity of persons who have made similar complaints to those made by the plaintiffs in this case represent a competing interest that the court ought to take into account if the request was narrowly drafted to include none others?
If that's what the request was, we would analyze it. To my knowledge, there's never been any individual who has made the complaint that Norma Smith has made in this case. The case of the Ballard case, the 1944 U.S. Supreme Court decision, very clearly states that men may believe what they cannot prove. They may not be put to the proof of their religious doctrines or beliefs. And that's exactly what opposing counsel is wanting to do. He's wanting these people to prove to his satisfaction or to some court's satisfaction that they indeed had a healing miracle. People have the fundamental right to freely worship as they choose. And if they choose to believe in divine healings, they're entitled to that. To compel disclosure of their identities to those who had different religious beliefs so that they could end up being subpoenaed to court and questioned about their beliefs or being asked to complete questionnaires, which is not necessarily on a voluntary basis. This is not a questionnaire they sought out to pick up and complete. This is something which they have received in the mail.
So you would object to even a more narrow court-supervised questionnaire?
Based on the background of this case and the court in which this case is filed, I would object.
I gather from your previous argument that the number of members of the church who have claimed to have been healed of medical illnesses and or physical abnormalities during the past 5 years is a very substantially smaller figure than 880,000 people.
It is smaller than that. I don't know how much smaller. This is a very devout group of individuals. They believe in the prosperity ministry. They are evangelical, and I would imagine that there are quite a few. But it would be less than 880,000 individuals.
And request number four is certainly not a request for the membership list of the church, is it?
It certainly includes partial membership list, absolutely.
partial membership list. What is that?
Well, it's asking for every member who has ever made these allegations. It is not asking for example, anyone who has had a financial miracle. And if you would look at the order of confidentiality, it basically protects financial and trade secrets of individuals and doesn't even cover the church members.
It's not your contention, has not been in this litigation, that every member of the church claims to have been healed of medical illnesses or physical abnormalities?
No, sir.
And you have been unable to give any estimate to either the trial court or this court of what portion of the membership of the church falls into that category?
I do not have that number with me. I do not have that number.
I gather from what you have been arguing that you, contention is that under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, there can be no tort liability of your client based on the allegations made by the plaintiffs in this case?
There is case law to that effect, and there is case law that says there can be tort liability.
Well, if you can't try the validity of individuals' religious beliefs, as you contend, what issue remains to be tried?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, it's going to be a difficult trial to keep out all of the religion, but I think it has to be done that way. The only remaining issue that I can possibly conceive of will be that the plaintiff, Norma Smith, will come into the trial court and will claim that she received correspondence directed to her deceased husband following his death. She opened it, and that caused her mental anguish. We don't believe that she would be able to meet the test of outrageous conduct, but that's where we are. That's the only remaining allegation.
I assume, given your refusal to provide this discovery and your desire to protect the confidentiality of the church members, that you would not anticipate having any of them brought in to the trial court to testify on your behalf.
It's not anticipated that that would happen. They have not enlisted as witnesses in this case, nor do we have that present intention.
Is the constitutional privilege of association one that belongs to Reverend Tilton or to the members and partners of your church?
It belongs to both.
But if either one of them wants out of that partnership, out of that privilege, they have the right to identify.
They do. So we would certainly honor that, and if Mr. Wright has been contacted by someone and were to send us a written waiver.
Right, and we've already covered that, but I'm not asking the question very well, but what I'm trying to get at is that do you believe the church and your clients have any association or claim merely because people have joined the church? Or are you here purely claiming, purely in a derivative sense, claiming the associational privilege that people who joined the church have, that their privilege is what you're claiming today, or are you claiming something of your own?
The privilege belongs to a person. The privilege belongs to Reverend Tilton and to the church members. I'm here on behalf of the church. And Reverend Tilton, as pastor and representative of the church, asserting that privilege on the church followers' behalf. And we do have standing to assert that under NAACP versus Alabama.
But it is the members of the church that you're here.
Yes.
Are there any other questions?
Is the case set for trial?
It was set for trial until this court entered a stay, and to my knowledge, we're not on any docket right now.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess and return to hear arguments in the next clause.